And it's time for our yearly segment of Industry Talk with we're here with co-host David Darcy and a couple of people that Dave knows intimately well.
Yes, well, let me introduce them. Bob Burney, former head of many distribution entities, and it would take us more than this segment to list them, list as distinctions. But Bob, give me your title at Amazon right now.
Head of Marketing and Distribution at Amazon Studios.
Okay. And John Sloss, also lawyer, sales mogul, I guess. Can we call you that, John?
As long as I don't call myself that, yes.
Okay. And how else do you want to identify yourself, John?
I'm in the service business. We have a company called Synetic Media, which is there to sort of help filmmakers get their films made and out into the world.
Okay. And the other guest is a woman I would describe as the late Ann Thompson. And how do you want to identify yourself? Again, there's a million ways to do that, but please talk right into the mic.
I am a constantly evolving being. And
you should have been on the Herzog segment.
I was listening. I was listening, and I was going, what the hell is he saying? No, and I'm interviewing him tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to it. IndieWire has been bought by Penske Media, and I am invited to the table, but we have to make a deal.
Well, okay, yeah. And we're really flattered that you came to this table first.
Yeah. And but if you're ever evolving, you could draw a group around you in some kind of self-realization kind of cult or something.
Believe me, they're calling.
I bet they are. All right, let's start. And on the outside of the industry, or at least not someone who's running a distribution company, how do you see this industry picture here as different from previous years which you've covered? What's different, and what are you noticing that we should be aware of?
I'm not flattering the man on my left, Bob Burney, but it does appear that Amazon and Netflix are major deep-pocketed players. They're changing the game, and they're in business with cash to buy things this time. More than ever. Last year, Amazon was quieter. This year, they were sort of putting deals. Last year, they were putting deals together. This year, they're going to pick up stuff. And there's an anxiety because the digital transition is really happening, and it's having an impact, and people are more concerned than ever about the future of theatrical distribution.
Okay, John, you're selling, is it 15 films here this year?
I think it's 37. No, it's 10.
Okay, do you agree with what Ann's saying? Is that
I'd like to see a little bit of that green from Amazon and Netflix. I have seen a little bit. But, yeah, it's an interesting, anxious time, I would say. Last year was pretty robust in the deal-making at Sundance, and now sort of famously a lot of those films underperformed. And I think there was some sense among the sellers that there was some buyer retribution later in the year. And there's wondering whether the traditional theatrical or all rights distributors are going to continue that here or whether they're going to get caught up in a buying spree like they did last year. It's kind of early days at the festival, so it's hard to know.
Okay, but just before Bob says something, we did not – Bob Burney, who has all this green supposedly according to John – did not pay us to allow him to come on this program.
No,
right?
In
right,
fact,
Bob?
He had to get permission to do it, which is a new thing, isn't it, Bob?
Well, we just let that we've made Utah history and let the cat out of the bag on so many things. Thanks, Ann. Okay, so to what extent is what they're characterizing accurate?
Well, I mean, I think it's true about Netflix and Amazon have obviously come really strong. There's I think kind of some big differences in terms of theatrical, in that what we're doing at Amazon is absolutely theatrical. Everything is in theaters first, and we're the Amazon Prime audience, the streaming audience, really wants to see films that have been discovered and talked about from the theatrical opening.
I think Bob's making an important point. There's a misperception, even within the industry, with knowledgeable people about what Amazon's processes or intentions are. And much closer to a traditional all rights theatrical distributor than they are to Netflix, which Netflix is much closer to sort of HBO in terms of controlling those rights and trying to keep them all strictly on Netflix.
And for me, it's kind of a familiar process working with filmmakers, trying to get their vision out and their, you know, working with them on the marketing. And so it's, for me, it's very, very, it's very cool because it's, we're enabling us to do a lot of films and in a big way.
Okay, we're talking about a relative, this is something that's just beginning. The one film that some of our listeners might be aware of that's an Amazon project is Chi-Raq. Talk about how this fits into that plan and what you learned from its performance so far.
Well, it was our first production and our first release, and we worked with a partner on it, Roadside Attractions, and we moved the film up. It was supposed to be later in the year, later in the summer, with all the stuff going on in Chicago and tapes being revealed and gang shootings and across the country, all sorts of events with Black Lives Matter. We really wanted to move the film and put it in as a touch point and for people to talk about it. And it worked really well. The reviews, it was really a kind of Spike's return to form in a way. Amazing reviews on a lot of 10 best list, and you know.
Well, the Chicago Police Department helped you out by doing something every few days to keep the news side of this going.
It was. I mean,
Spike knows what he's
and,
doing.
And I suppose there was no Amazon Green going to any of those guys.
It was no. Okay.
Just want to clear that one.
It was really amazing. We had a big premiere in Chicago, and that morning of the premiere, we also took the whole cast and crew and Spike down to St. Sabina Church in Southside and had a mass for the film with the cast and crew. And it was really, really interesting because the character in the film played by John Cusack, this guy's really, he's been there 40 years in the gun, you know, anti-gun violence movement and everything. So he and Spike were perfect partners to make this film.
Okay. How did Chi-Raq do in theaters, and what did it perform? Was this what your expectations were? How did it fit into your expectations?
Well, it fit into our expectations of making a bold film and putting it out in a new model. The theatrical, we did a short theatrical in the beginning of December, and we knew it was going to be constrained because Star Wars, you know, was opening after that. So it was a trade-off of getting it in to tie into all the issues, and really, I think it worked, got great reviews, and I think in putting it in that context made the film work. And we're doing a huge push. It comes on Prime February 5th, so pretty soon. So we're doing a big launch, and we'll see if people really work. But I think it made a big splash, and the awareness now for Prime is huge.
So Bob, it sounds like the model you're saying that still prevails is getting into a theater first, even if it's a token appearance in a theater.
Well, it's yes. I mean, it's not token though. It's shorter, right? We want to move it quicker, but it's certainly not token. I would say our campaign and PNA was equal or bigger to the large distributors.
Make an argument for why a month in a theater is really beneficial for Prime as opposed to the Netflix model, which is day and date.
Well, a little bit just from our research and everything is that I think Prime, the customers really want to discover, they want films that have been talked about and discovered in with reviews and editorial and everything in theaters, just like when a film comes to a streaming service or a pay TV service with built-in awareness rather than, you know, direct to the service. I mean, Amazon obviously has TV series and Transparent that have done very well there, but this is a different model.
So are these films all going to be English language? Is there any room for foreign language in this model?
I think there could be exceptions. I mean, I think the main, as Ted Hope and Roy Price said, like sort of visionary directors are the focus and concentrating on U.S., but there definitely is always an exception.
If I could just chime in, one of the criticisms of Netflix from the film community is that they have not really shared their data about how many people are watching their films. And you guys, I think your whole model is more filmmaker-friendly because you allow for theatrical and TVOD. Are you going to also follow that through when it's on Prime and maybe share more consumption data from the SVOD service?
You know, I don't know. That's a Roy and upstairs question. But so I don't know. I mean, I think the idea is to be overall Amazon for the studios and dealing with you, with filmmakers. It's to definitely be transparent in terms of our deals and how we sort of report. So, but in terms of the numbers, I don't know. I can't tell you.
So, what's the advantage of getting that information? Why? What do you benefit? How do you benefit from that?
Well, as you know, David, knowledge is power.
It helps him make deals.
I feel weaker every day.
Yeah. You know, it's. I would say it's more diffuse. It's good information, obviously, to know what films are popular. And, you know, I think the argument that the portals will make against you is that, well, if we give you that information that your film was wildly popular or this type of film was wildly popular, then next time out you're going to try to hold us up for more money or something like that.
So should Bob expect that you will disclose what you're paid for the films that you're selling?
My life is an open book, as you know.
So you have a big
premiere
tonight.
Answer the question, folks.
So Love and Friendship is one of you followed up Chirac, right?
Yeah, our film premiering tonight at Sundance is Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship that John also worked on, and it's Kate Beckinsale and Chloe Sevigny who kind of reunited from Last Days of Disco, and it's really fun because Whit, I was talking earlier, I think Whit and Jane Austen, that's a team. I mean, that is like, it's sort of like you in the big movie posters, you know, we have the big just last names only. We were just talking earlier.
Yeah. It's Austen?
It's Austen and Stillman. Yeah. Austen and Stillman.
How did Whit's last film perform? Did you sell that film, John, the last one?
Well, it was actually financed. It was financed by a company that has a deal at Sony, and so Sony released it. I think most people would consider it a disappointment in terms of its performance. You know, as far as I've worked with Whit since Metropolitan, and he never makes a false step as far as I'm concerned. So it's I think there's some head scratching as to why it underperformed so much. Anne may feel differently. Yeah. This one.
Does Anne want to share anything with the class? No.
This one.
I mean, you know, we started with transparency, and now we've got these silent people behind microphones.
No, this, you know, if there were ever two people in literary history fated to spend time together, in my opinion, it's Jane Austen and Whit Stillman. And I think he delivers on this one.
He does. It's great. I think a lot of times at Sundance, there's a lot of, you know, dark stuff going on. A lot of rough films, and this is going to deliver fun. So it should be really, really nice
okay,
tonight.
Very briefly, tell us what the story is.
Well, it's Whit doing. It's based on her novella, but so he expanded it, he added character to it. But essentially, think of Metropolitan. The way his characters speak in New York in Metropolitan, it translates perfectly to period. In fact, we were saying we think we have a time machine. We're going to just send Whit back. He's going to be there.
Well, he might say that between films, he felt like he was being sent back at certain points in his career.
I think he's been really busy doing that. You know, a lot in Paris, I guess. And
yeah,
he's been. You know, this. I don't want to look at it as a return or anything. But I think this is it's a great material for him, and I think it's very. Very popular and commercial.
Is this at the Eccles tonight?
Yeah.
What time?
9:30. 9:45.
Okay.
I wonder, can any of you folks tell me, are we in the world now where, in the old Hollywood days, it was, MGM presents. Now it's a picture is preceded by about six or seven, the titles or logos of six or seven production companies. I think last year at one of the Sundance screenings, the audience started counting. Like the ball was coming down over Times Square, the number of production companies and financiers that were backing up the movie. You know, six, seven, eight, nine.
I mean, that's actually part of a long tradition from sort of European co-productions. If you've looked at European co-productions since, the 60s and 70s or maybe even before, you will see – the list of all those companies, basically one from each territory who were co-production partners on a film. I think the idea that it's kind of migrated over here is that everyone is now so focused on branding. And if you have an opportunity to do an animated logo or a name and get them on the front of the film, then people are much savvier now and they take advantage of that.
It's gone from listing, you know, in the European to these long lists to an animated logo.
Yeah.
And so it's always, you know, it does take time. And it's always an argument, you know, with like with Josh Kramer and John talking about who gets one. How many animated? I mean,
as far as I'm concerned, it's often the most exciting part of the film.
Well, it's like,
we're back to transparency. Thank God.
Well, it's like that joke they did on Family Guy, where Peter thinks the movie is about to start, but it's just the animated logo of one of the companies and guy running into cabin or something.
You see, this is going to be a short next year at Sundance called Animated Logo.
But you know, I think we all know this, and you probably know it as well because we're all sort of film geeks. But for years, I've sat and watched the end credits of a film because the end credits of a film are a narrative in themselves.
True.
And you can really tell who did what and how things came together and what the challenges were. And so, it's funny. It's sort of dismaying sometimes when you go to multiplexes and the place and you're sitting there alone watching the end credits. I think if you really love movies, as many people do, I really encourage people to stay and watch those credits.
Can you talk about some of the nuances to watch for there? I mean, so that you're not sitting through the credits just to see the little tag that Marvel puts on the end or something.
Well, you can see how many visual effects people there were working on a given thing. You can see all the film commissions and all the locations. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing I learned.
And which producer has more assistance than the other producer, and who the insect wrangler was, and
right. But beyond
Geeks
that, but beyond that, it does get an idea. Also, I think that how many people it takes to make these things and involve. So it's also an appreciation.
You're watching, now I hope I get this title right, Dark Knight. You can see that it's shot in Sarasota, Florida.
Right.
Or you can find out where all these kind of, you know, sightless or unspecific site locations really are, where people are actually shooting films these days.
And for particularly for the people within the listening distance of this show, if you're an aspiring filmmaker, you can really decode how a film was financed, and that's really important information.
Okay, where in that finance picture, John, where are we going to be 5 years from now?
Right here. Talking to
that,
you.
Okay, that, you know, he's, you know, I
the
keep...
The traditions die hard.
Yes. Traditions die hard, but this is John's first appearance on a KPCW show. We invited him a million times in the old days, and we finally showed up.
Now he has a management company.
Yeah. Right. Okay, but five years...
Now I have to be nice, so I'm here I am.
You're doing pretty well.
All right.
Okay, yeah, 5 years from now, what are we going to see that we're seeing the beginnings of that you
I mean, there's a wild fractionization, if that's a word, fractionalization of where people are viewing content, how it's being delivered. You know, and to use another jargon, distributors sometimes are being disintermediated, and creators are going directly to portals, places people can actually watch their content. They're marketing directly to their communities. So I think, you know, the distinction between features and episodics, you know, length is going to become less important, and it's going to be more atomized. I don't see that as a bad thing, frankly.
Are we going to see new sources of capital, which will become major concentrations of players?
I mean, there's never been more money for the making of content in my 30 years than there is right now. Capital is not a problem. There are more very rich people than there probably ever been in human history.
That does not mean that the quality of the films is going up, and but to your earlier point, the theaters, I was at the Art House Convergence, they're actually, because the distribution mechanisms are still gridlocked a little bit, there's a lot of product, but there isn't an easy way to get it to the consumer. It still hasn't been resolved entirely. And so the theaters are actually going to festivals, seeing movies, and booking them directly. They're completely skipping the distribution part.
But there's always been too many films made. There's no question. For people who watch these films, we know that. And when 22 films open on a weekend in New York, there's no way any kind of viewing audience can sustain that.
Yeah. And when only five of them have James Franco in them. Bob, you ran theaters. You ran theaters and did okay. Would you go into that business today?
Well, I mean, you'd have to have so much capital to do it. I do think that, you know, it is about, you know, at Amazon, you know, it's about the customers and, them finding them films in different ways. And I think exhibitors, the ones that are providing a really good experience, are going to do well. If you look at theaters that have, you know, increased the size of their screen or amenities or seating, you know, there's been a real change in terms of, you know, like the ArcLight chain, Landmark, AMC adding all these new seats. So to increase the customer experience, it's working. Also, I think technology, different apps so that people can find tickets and get there, just like, you know, just in the way Uber has taken over. Like, there are apps that are doing ticket sales. So if you provide the customers, you know, what they want, I think it'll benefit. If you don't and sit back, you'll be in real trouble.
Okay, we've noticed that there is a population that is over 50, over 60 now, maybe over 65, that grew up being accustomed to seeing films in theaters, that still goes. The films that have been made, what was Rob Reiner's film that was made for that audience? I forget the title of it.
Grumpy Old Men, no.
Not Grumpy Old Men, with Michael Douglas as a guy.
Vegas? That wasn't him, though. Leaving Las Vegas?
Nope. It was, anyway, let's take it away from that specific reference, but the films that seem to be made for that that audience have not risen to the level of quality that would make anyone go to see them.
I beg your pardon? That's not necessarily true.
Well, there's a robust art house audience that is older. The question is, when do they get the younger people to come? Yeah. It's the young male demo that is the most compromised in terms of theatrical across the board in Hollywood.
Why is that?
I mean, we have a film at this festival that is arguably the only film at this festival aimed at that audience, called Sophie and the Rising Sun. And it played huge. It's going to do very well. I think that those films have over-indexed in recent years. And, you know, films like Mr. Holmes, I mean, there are quality films out there.
45 years.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying that they're all bad, but many of them are. And many of them that seem to be targeted just for that audience are among the least attractive.
But it's like everything else. Whenever you try to target a certain audience, it's all about what's a film is really good within that audience. It's all these genres that take off. Everybody might want to, you know, get involved or copy or make. But ultimately, it's always about what films are really good within that world.
Yes, as opposed to, did anyone, John, was The Turbo Kid one of your films last year?
No.
Okay.
It depends. Did you like it?
I didn't like it as much as the people who made it did.
But Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, the big hit of Sundance last year, aimed at a younger demo. Fox Searchlight picked it up for a lot of dollars, and it just didn't perform. What, you know, there's got to be a better way.
I like that film a lot.
Yeah.
Why,
yeah.
John?
Why?
I mean, look at Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a film aimed for that audience. Performed, it's the best performing film out of Sundance last year.
And I'll a lot
see
of these,
you, See You in My Dreams. You know.
Yeah, See You in My Dreams. A lot of these films for that audience are also awards contenders.
Okay, we're going to get
to the Woods was the biggest.
Okay, awards. Okay, first. We've got Anne here.
Oh no, yeah,
here we is. Okay,
I'm on vacation from awards.
Yeah, well, too bad.
Although that wasn't true yesterday.
Too bad. First, are you going to do 10 to 12 features a year? Is that still your plan?
Yes.
Okay.
Wow.
Where are you going to find them?
Well,
from me.
Yeah. In fact, quite a few actually are from John. But at all the usual places. Obviously, the big festivals tend to be the places. But there's a lot of Ted, Hope, a lot of pre-buying from scripts and financing films. But yeah, there's a lot of filmmakers out there, obviously, that there's enough.
Okay. And there's some green attached to that, according to John Sloss. Anne, come on. Best picture. We're running out of time.
Three-way race, Revenant, Spotlight, Big Short. I'll give it to Spotlight right now.
Okay, best director. You guys can all chime in, please.
And best director is George Miller, and there isn't a God if he loses.
Well, we're in Utah. There's a God for certain people.
And we have 30 seconds to wrap up all the
best,
other traditions.
Best actor.
Leo. No one's going to challenge that. The Revenant will win the most.
Actress.
And George,
actress.
That one is a race, but I think it'll be Brie Larson in Room.
Documentary at Sundance. We got to ask that one.
Ooh. Amy.
What do you think, John?
Well, I got two horses in that race, and I love them equally like children.
What are they?
Cartel Land and Amy.
Both good films.
And I think it'll be a dead heat tie, and they'll both get the Oscar.
Okay. First time.
History made again.
History made again.
John's first appearance on the show.
John from Synetic Media for his first appearance here. Hope we get him back next year. Film critic and journalist Ann Thompson, and Bob Burney, film industry distributor, and like Bob Hawke, maybe a documentary about him next year.
Bob Hawke is screening tomorrow morning. He is a legend, and he deservedly so. Everybody should come see it.
Are you selling that film, John?
Coincidentally, yes.
Okay. Thanks to my co-host, David Darcy. This is Sundance Weekend. We'll see you tomorrow. And again, to remind, this is presented from Mark Miller Subaru. Love the experience at markmillersubaru.com.
Branding.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Ed.
I own an Outback, and I love it.
Pleasure.
Okay.